verse 38. And something I want to sort of mention ahead of time, verse 38, chapter 4 of Malcolm Bat, something I kind of want to mention ahead of time, which is the stories have shifted to Elisha's responsibility. That is, the first story was Elisha taking over, and Elisha has to convince Beit El and Yericho that he is worth taking over the position of the head of the Nevi'im. The second story, and he does a little miracle, the bears kill the people in Beit El because they weren't ready to take on his leadership, and he helps the people in Yericho because Yericho was convinced that he was a miracle man anyway because he split the Jordan River. After that, we have the poor woman whose husband died, who he does the trick with the unending oil. Now, there's an interesting story because on one it combines sort of both aspects of what his job is. On one hand, she's essentially, she has like a life insurance policy because her husband was from the Bnei Nevi'im that were probably killed out by Jezebel, by Yezebel. And she's saying to him, listen, you need to take care of us. So she's sort of in a role where she's, on one hand, she's hoi polloi. She's the common man who's in trouble who needs help. And on the other hand, she's sort of like a remnant of the body which Elisha's planning to take over. Then the scene shifts to the woman from Shunem, which is purely a nationalistic, that is purely, what could I do for the people? There's no prophets involved there, except for himself and Gehazi. It's purely, how do I help the people and how do the people help me? Now the camera is shifting back, essentially, to his own responsibility, which is essentially a band of Nevi'im that work for him. So essentially what we're looking at is a revival of the school of Nevi'im that we haven't seen, actually, for a good 100 years. And I'll get through the story, and then I'll mention when the last time we saw it, and you'll see some connections between the last time we saw a band of Nevi'im. So essentially, each story focuses on a different role that Elisha had to play, one with the masses, one with his own people, one with the prophets, and we'll see then he actually goes to Syria and does some business there as well. So the Elisha Shafa Gilgala, so he goes back to the Gilgala. Now this is very strange, because Elisha wasn't in the Gilgal. Elisha was on Mount Carmel, which is by Haifa. The Gilgal, hi, good evening. The Gilgal was the place right where when Yeshua took his forces of Israel into the first penetration into Israel back way after Moses died, after Moshe died. That was the Gilgal. That was the first shop where they first set up the Mishkan. It's essentially right in the Jordan Valley Rift, east of Jericho. So right away you could tell that these stories are out of place. That is, they're not in sequential order. There's another thing which gives you a clue, which is Elisha Shavu Gazal Harav Ba'aretz, and there was a terrible famine in the land. But we don't meet the famine in the land until chapter 8. Remember, we read that at the very end of last week, where we said there was a great famine in the land going to be for 7 years, and he told the woman who he had saved years before, saved her some years before, she should get out of town for a while, and then she comes back, and etc., etc. So right away you could tell that we're in Ein Mukdam Mukhar B'Torah. We're not in chronological order. And the question is, why? So the only thing I would answer is because the book of Elisha was written to tell a certain theme. And it's touching on all the different aspects of Elisha's life. And first it wanted to deal with him taking over charge. The second thing and taking care of his people. The second thing he wanted to do was taking care of, you know, the masses. And now it's going back to his own people who he is in charge to take over with. And he's got all the Nevi'im and they're all sitting before him, which means that essentially what you have is, it's not clear Elisha will survive the revolution of Yehu, what we haven't met yet, which will signify the death of Yezebel. It's one of the last things he'll do is kill off Yezebel, because Yezebel is alive and well. During ostensibly, we're in Ahab's son's time. That would be the chronological order. We met Ahab's son. The first one died by falling through a hole. The second one in the roof. The second one took over, and he ruled for 8 years, and he seems to be doing well. The question is, where is this story? I would have to say this story is much later because the famine happens much later. But in addition, I would say it had to happen later because otherwise the school, at least would be hard-pressed to put together a school of prophets with Yezebel on the loose. So again, that's another indication that we're essentially into future land. Why tell it here? Because it wants to make a point about his responsibility, his bringing back the school of prophets back to life. Elisha Shavu Gavar Arav Baretz, Uvnei Hanevi'im Yoshevim Lefanav. We're in chapter 4, verse 38. Vayomer Lena'aro, he said to his servant, who probably is none other than Gehazi, Shifot Hasir Hagdolah, the Shafot is a very difficult word. It probably means something like, put out or place out or organize the big pot. Uvashel Nazid Livnei Hanavim. I want you to cook food for the prophet school. So first of all, as I mentioned, among other things which I mentioned, is that there's a lot of calling back to Sefer Bereishit. This is another one of those things that call it back to Sefer Bereishit, because you have the word Nazid, which of course was kind of reminiscent of the Aesop story. Vayetze echad el asadeh. So one of them goes out to the field. Now it's a little unclear who echad is, but one of his prophets goes to the field. Laket oro, to go cut vegetables for big trones he's making. Vayimtzad gefen sadeh. Very difficult to say what that means. Literally, it means grapes of the field, but I have a feeling it's probably speaking of some other fruit, which were called, the grapes of the field, like we would call grapefruit today, but not grapefruit, probably some other kind of vegetable. Vayilakeit mimenu pkuot sadeh melo vigdo. And he gathered from around this gefenah sadeh, he gathered pkuot sadeh, which is another vegetable, we just don't know what it is. According to Chazal, it's mushrooms of some type. That is, toadstools. He gathered toadstools, which is an unwise idea unless you know exactly what you are doing. By the way, the word shemen pakuot shows up in, if I'm not mistaken, in what do we say between Mincha Marv on Shabbat? I mean, between the Kabbalat Shabbat and Marv, Bamei Malik, and I believe one of the shemens they're not supposed to use is shemen pakuot. So it was no Chazal thought they knew what it was. The guess here is some kind of mushrooms. Malo big dough, so he filled up his cloak with it. Vayavo yifalach el sir nazid, so he cut them up and threw them into the chalent. Kilo yada'u, because he did not know. Now what that means, kilo yada'u, first of all, it's very difficult. It really is because they did not know. They did not know what. So the Mefarshim say they didn't know how bitter this food was, and we're about to find out how unsatisfactory these pakuot are, as if they didn't know what was going on. Another possibility is he just threw it into the chalent without letting anybody know what he was doing. Had they known what he was doing, they wouldn't have let him do it. But it's a little hard to say what the issue is. Vayitzku l'anashim v'yechol. So they pour out for everybody to eat. They give a little bit of everybody of food. Vayihi ko'ochlami anazid, when they eat the chalent. Vehema tzaku, they all start screaming. Vayomu mavet basir yishalohim. There's death in the pots. It's a bad, bad good evening. It's a bad, bad, bad chalent. It's about the worst you can imagine. Now, I don't think it's poisonous. I guess it's possible it's poisonous. Maybe they just ate a bite and recognized right away that there was something inherently poisonous. Was it a toadstool? Was it actually poisonous? According to most Mefarshim, it wasn't poisonous. It was simply bitter. Simply bitter. Although, again, the word mavet basir could be taken either metaphorically, that chalent would be the death of you, or it could be literally as in there's, something poisonous in the chalent. And they didn't know, of course, that the mushrooms were in there because the Navi who went out to get them didn't tell anybody that he was putting the mushrooms in.
The comment is the mushrooms were poisonous.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. Most of the Mefarshim actually don't take it like that. They just say that it was mar, lo yadushu mar. Again, it depends on whether you want to say mavet is a metaphor or not, whether they're saying, ooh, it's deadly, or whether they mean, it's really deadly.
Well, it could have tasted so bad that you said, this must be deadly.
Right, correct. Sometimes it's hard to tell. There's a fine line. It's true. Ishalavim, v'lo yachlu l'achol. They couldn't eat the food. Lo yachlu l'achol sounds more like, it's hard to say. I don't know, it doesn't exactly sound poisonous, but something's wrong. Vayomer k'chu kemach. So Elisha says, take flour. Vayashlech el hasir, throw it into the pot. Vayomer tzak la'am vayochelo, and then he tells them to pour it out to everybody they ate. Now people already had it in their dishes, so I guess they kind of pour the junk back into the big vat, the cauldron, and then he threw in the kamach. Velo haya davar ra basir, it took away everything bad that was in the pot. That's it. End of story. It's a really strange story. It's a cooking show. Elisha does cooking on the cooking channel. It's a very strange thing. The only thing I could say from this follows the motif of Elisha pulling off miracles in ways that could be described as natural. With the boy that he does the mouth-to-mouth, and he walks seven times, and he comes back seven times, and he puts his face onto it. Now, they didn't know what mouth-to-mouth was, but it wasn't like he snapped his fingers and the boy popped back to life. He did something by breathing into the boy. You could say, maybe that's part of the medicine, so to speak. Here, too, don't know, maybe there's something about Kemach that cancels the either the taste or the properties of these pakuot, of these mushrooms or whatever they were. Just like with the woman who locked the door behind her before any miracle started happening so that nobody could see them. So this is again in the kind of line where he's pulling off miracles, but he seems to be doing it specifically in a way that allows one to believe that it's not miraculous. And the reason why this is important, it's going to come up in chapter 5, is because don't forget, he's everything in a sense that Eliyahu wasn't. Eliyahu was into big, fiery miracles.
Yeah.
And Elisha's goal was to communicate with the people, to get the people involved. And here, too, you have miracles where essentially he doesn't even perform the miracle. Who performs the miracle? The people, the cooks. He goes to the chefs. I guess they had a bunch of chefs among the Nevi'im. And he said, I want you to throw in flour and that'll make everything okay. So they're involved in the process of sort of healing themselves, which is very typical Elisha. To my mind, they picked this particular story to put in here to tell him that he was helping his own people, to bring it into light that he is reestablishing the house of Nevi'im, the school of Nevi'im, which I'm going to get to in a second because it recalls the last time you had a house of Nevi'im, but I'll sort of give it away, was in Shmuel's time. And we'll see connections between him and Shmuel. And just to simply give you a sense of what kind of magician he was. I mean a magician in the right way. What kind of miracles he was working with, which were certainly not Eliyahu style miracles.
I mean, like he told Naaman to go into the
dip in the water. That's exactly right. Even though and Naaman was saying, I was waiting for you to do your whole hocus pocus thing.
Yeah, right.
Exactly right. We'll see that in the coming chapter. That's exactly the point. It's a motif that really unifies all of these seemingly segmented
stories.
The
waters in Damascus are just as good as
We'll see that. Exactly. We're getting to that. Hopefully, I think we'll get to it today, and we'll see. It's a very strange exchange between the two of them.
Is there any connection between this and when Moshe threw the
I think so, but it's also a connection between what he did with Yericho. When he came to Yericho, they all said, oh, the waters of Yericho are bitter. So he took salt and he threw it in to make it sweet, which is sort of like the opposite of what you would expect. So I think that this is, it's similar to Moshe, but the truth is it's similar to himself.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say exactly what I would say the first story, if anything, recalls Moshe, and this story really is, take two. Yeah, recalls himself. All right, so let's now go ahead to the next chapter and see if we can find a connection between this new story of miracles. V'ish ba mi Baal Shalisha. A man came from a place called Baal Shalisha. Now that's very important. The name of the place is incredibly important, but I'm going to skip why it's important just for now to get the story, and then I'm going to go back to where the person was coming from. V'yave l'ish Elohim lechem bikurim esrim lechem sorim charmel b'tziklona. So, this is not one of the prophets. This is just a guy. And he has a whole bunch of wheat, and he wants barley, and he wants to bring, and Carmel is probably like new wheat, but Ciclono, by the way, nobody had any idea what this was, by the way. Nobody had any clue. Most of the Mepharshim went with some kind of pot. What else would you bring the Carmel in? Radak says it is the chaff of the wheat, the stuff that surrounds the wheat. And actually, it wasn't until Umberto Casuto, who was the head of the Bible department in Hebrew University, who wrote the famous dispute against the documentary hypothesis, or one of the famous disputes against the documentary hypothesis. So he found an ancient Ugaritic writings, which date back to about the year 1400, which is half a millennium before this. So they found the word Ugaritic in Ciclano, and it turns out Radak was right. It was a good guess, essentially. And it's actually not Ciclano. The bet is part of the Shorash, believe it or not. It sounds like bit Ciclano is in the Cicla. But it's not. The Carmel Bitsiklono is Carmel and the Bitsakel, which is with the wheat. That is, Carmel Bitsiklono is one term, which means sort of still encased wheat. So it's an Ugaritic word, which was an old Phoenician tongue, which was Proto-Semitic. A lot of the words in Hebrew can be found in one form or the other in Ugaritic. So that was a good find when we dug up that in the early 1900s. In any event, Vayomer Tain La'am Vayochelu. So he says to the people, don't give it to me. Give it to the people and let them eat. Well, it's not quite clear who he's talking to, but he says to somebody, Tain et La'am Vayochelu. Now here I want to mention something interesting. What you have here now, what's new about this when it comes to what Elisha's role is? For the first time in a long time, people who are coming from different places in Israel to bring something nice to the prophets. does the prophet sort of recognize as the rabbi of the time, and if you have something that you want to do, you bring him a gift of some sort. Now, the word Lechem Bikurim may sound like it's actually part of a Bikurim, as if he was acting as a Kohen Gadol. Chazal say, Minayin Shu Kohen Gadol, who says a Kohen Gadol? So that's not the way to interpret it. Lechem Bikurim doesn't necessarily mean the first fruits. It means, it means the first fruits in a cultic sense, where you bring the food to the Kohen. But it could also mean any first fruits. It could also be the best. Well, probably Bachur. Bikur, Levaker, usually means ripe, just ripened fruits. I don't think there's no sense here that he took them and he offered them as a sacrifice, which is what some Bible critics want to say. No, he just brought him, like he said, I want to bring some of my best fruits and give it to the Navi. Now, don't forget the story. Now I'll take you back to Shmuel. Shaul was wandering around his fields looking for his father's donkey. He's wandering all over the place, and one of the places he stops off is Eretz Shalisha, which is the same place where this guy is coming from. He went to Enoch Shual, and one of the places he went is Eretz Shalisha, which is supposed to recall that story, which should, because what happened? Shaul says, listen, we don't know where our donkeys are. Let's go and ask the prophet where the donkeys are. This is one of those cases where sometimes you ask the prophet big questions, and sometimes you ask the prophet, hey, tell me where my donkeys are. So the guy says, we can't go and ask where the donkeys are because we've got no money. You've got to bring a gift to the Navi. That was the policy at the time. So what you're looking at here is Elisha is essentially reestablishing the Shmuel school of prophetics, and it was a big school. If you remember back in the story in Shmuel Aleph, when David is on the outs and Shaul the king is trying to kill David, David runs away to Shmuel the prophet's town for safety. He had a whole town where they trained Nevi'im. It was a big school where they trained Nevi'im. There was Nevi'im popping here and Nevi'im popping there. It was this big school. And people could join the school, in fact, because Shaul the king runs after David. He gets to the city and he starts to be Minabe. He starts to have kind of an ecstatic prophecy. He rips off all his clothes and he falls on the floor naked. And then David managed to escape while Shaul was busy with this ecstatic prophecy, although it wasn't exactly a prophecy. It was just a state of ecstasy. This is all in Shmuel Aleph, around your chapter 20 to 25. So here, once again, what you see is Elisha sort of reestablishing. It's a very healthy sign. Elisha, first, he takes care of the people. He takes care of the widow of the prophets. He takes care of the prophets, and now what's happening is what you would want to happen. After doing all these little tiny things, what's happening is people are starting to say, you know what? Why don't we bring the Rebbe some, let's bring the Rebbe some food. And that's what they start to do, which means that you're essentially, instead of converting people from the outside, which is what Eliyahu was doing with his big bang, 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 he's converting people from the inside. People aren't believing in Elisha because he is a miracle maker. They could barely tell he's a miracle maker. They believe in Elisha because they believe in Elisha. He's a good guy, nice guy, helps people out, does nice things for people, and starts a nice school where people learn Torah and people talk to God, and that's attracting people, and that's a very positive thing, and that's essentially what Elisha is the best at.
Do people don't think he's performing miracles?
I think they do, but every miracle that he performed, you could also have the guy next to you going, I'm not sure that was a miracle. I think maybe he's got a doctor's degree, he knows what to do. Or with that woman we never saw, if the door was closed, if it was really a miracle, how come he didn't put on the show? Each one of his miracles could easily be explained away. And look at this, the wheat. Take the flour. So someone will say, I never knew before that flour cancels out the flavor of whatever was in. I don't know what was in there because we don't know what the guy put in, but whatever it was, the flour, God, Elisha, is he a great prophet? Yeah, but you know what he really knows? The guy knows cooking. I mean, it's just a nice thing to know about your prophet. You would never go to Eliyahu and ask him for cooking tips. You just wouldn't. He'd fry you is what he'd do. But you would go over and you'd talk to Elisha about cooking tips and he'd tell you how to make your cholent pot very nicely. I think people probably did it. I think if you had the right mindset, you saw it as a miracle. If you didn't have the right mindset, so you saw a nice guy doing nice things for a lot of nice people. Either way, it's a win-win situation, which is something that Eliyahu really never had. And that's why Elisha is able to succeed where Eliyahu didn't. We haven't seen the success yet, but he's about to start in a revolution that topples the Ahav government, the Ahav dynasty, which is exactly what God wanted, because the Ahav dynasty was a Baal-worshipping dynasty, and God couldn't stand it. Anyway, let's continue on. Vayomer Mesharto. So then his servant says, so this is probably Gehazi, Ma etein zelifnei mea ish. How am I going to put this amount of food, which is essentially 10 loaves of bread, in front of 100 people? And this is where the character assassination starts coming on Gehazi, if this is indeed Gehazi. If you remember, I'm not sure I mentioned it, but I believe I mentioned in Medrash last time about how he told Gehazi to take the staff and don't talk to anybody on the way to take care of the boy, and nothing happened when he put the staff on the boy. It didn't work. And Chazal say, what happened? He took the staff, and instead of not stopping to talk to everybody, he stopped to talk to everybody. He said, oh, look, he wants to save this guy with the staff. What an idiot, right? That was that's the kind of thing. He was doubting his master's ability to perform a miracle. Here it's Beferish. Here is where Chazal were able to borrow the story and apply it back to, even though what Elchanan Samet says is that really they were doing, that the assassination was only in the words of Chazal. And the text itself, in the previous chapter with the Shunamid, there was no real, you couldn't prove anything. You couldn't really say that the text was supporting character assassination. But here's where it all comes from. So he says, Ma'atein Zelifnei Me'aish, I can't feed them with 10 pieces of bread. Vayomer tein la'am vayochelu, let them eat, and tein la'am vayochelu, and they will eat. Kiko amar Adonai achol vahoter, so says God, eat and have left over. Vayitein lefneim, he gave it to them. Vayochelu vayotiru dvar Adonai, and a miracle happened. Now again, I don't know what kind of miracle that is. Did they eat and then what was in their hands was still there? When they passed the bread to the next guy, was there an extra 3 or 4 ounces on it? I mean, it's hard to say exactly how this miracle took place. It's hard to even imagine. With Eliyahu's miracles, you can imagine fire comes down from the sky, you got a hurricane, stuff like that. Here, it's hard to get a handle on exactly what the miracle was. At what point did the bread enlarge, you know? Was it like in one of those Willy Wonka things where the guy's going and it gets smaller and smaller and the room gets bigger and bigger? Or?
He broke off a piece of bread, gave it to him, and normally they'd be hungry after that little piece. They were very satisfied.
Oh. Okay, that's not what the pasuk says.
Well,
that's a nice idea.
It says he gave him.
Yeah, you want to know something? You know what?
And it was left over.
And it was left over because they ate enough and they were satisfied.
It's
wow.
A sleight of hand. There really were more than 10 loaves.
Well, because the truth is, I never thought about Arnie's idea before, and I had a sort of a knee-jerk rejection to it. But you want to know something sort of nice? Eat a little bit of food. It's like the Lembas wafers in Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. You eat a little bit, and it lasts you for a trip. So the reason it was left over is not because the bread grew, but just because people ate a little bit, and like, wow, I'm satisfied, which is really nice, because then you really have a miracle, which you can barely tell is a miracle, which is very nice. The only way you know that God is involved is to say, Kol Amar Hashem, because apparently God told him to pull this off. Yeah, it's nice. It's nice, actually. I never thought of it, but you know what? It really makes a beautiful miracle. It makes a beautiful Elisha-style miracle.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very nice. It's very nice. All right. Let's continue on. And that's the end of that story. End of story. Miracle man. Let's continue on to the next story. But again, what we're doing here, even though it looks like disconnected stories, it's really trying to build the character of Elisha was all about. Also, when did God speak to him? It says, Kol Amar Hashem. This also begs back to Shmuel, because when Shaul was looking for him, God came to Shmuel and said, the guy who's coming to you, sit him down at your table because he's going to be the king. The guess here is that while this guy was coming from Eretz Shalisha to bring him bread, God whispered into Elisha's ear, so to speak, and he said, this is what I want you to do with the bread that you're about to get. So to my mind, there's a lot of Shmuel and Navi stuff going on here, which is a very positive thing. All right, and now we have the next step, which is a new miracle, and now Elisha's involved in politics. And unfortunately, this is going to be a very exciting chapter, but it's also going to be a very depressing chapter, because this is where defeat is snatched from the hands of victory. Is that the right phrase?
Mm.
They're going to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, or something like that. Well, no, because it's going to be a defeat here. Something bad is going to happen here, unfortunately. V'Naaman Sar Tzva Melech Aram. So chapter 5, verse 1. There was a guy named Naaman, which, by the way, is a pretty Jewish name. It's Noam, right? Same spelling as Noam.
Yeah.
What we're going to see here is the people of Syria and Israel are very much, they had the same language, more or less. Aramaic and Hebrew are close languages. And while they were fighting with each other, there was also a lot of stuff going on that you don't see, a certain amount of interplay. We saw that with Hadad and Achav. One day they're fighting, and the other day they're making peace. I suspect it would be like that also if it wasn't... I can tell you something very interesting. There was my Rebbe's daughter, who I think came to speak. Did Warman come here to speak? And did she speak about the Cohen gene?
Oh, I don't remember.
Well, one of the things that she mentioned about the Cohen gene, it's very interesting, is that the Cohen gene is found amongst two peoples, Kohanim in Israel and certain people in Syria. And what that means is it's passed father to father in the Y chromosome. Am I getting that right? Y chromosome from him? So that would mean that, I'm sorry, I kept between a doctor and a geneticist. I think I'm in reasonably safe. What? You're yielding to the geneticist? So what's interesting is that means that there was a certain amount of intermarriage you know, among the Syrian line as well. They're not quite as far distant as we think. That is, religious-wise, there's a massive divide. But I suspect that race-wise, there's less of a divide between the Jewish people and Syrians and Damascus as we would like to think.
From Africa.
What?
According to was a certain part of Africa.
Did they also find it in Africa?
They found a higher statistical
amongst the Ethiopians, huh?
Oh, so I get, well, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if...
Found it?
I think so.
Would that be a mother, that would be a mother thing,
yeah,
right?
That would be a mother thing.
Right, as Arnie said, that's kind of the Ethiopian thing. I mean, they have the Masorah. We could only trust that it's right, even though we convert them, you know, we convert them. But that's really because they didn't have Gittin.
Not the Russians.
What's that?
Yeah,
well, the Russians is risky altogether because a lot of people come just to, because it's better than living in Russia. So there's a certain risk. But anyway, let me avoid
but
that topic.
Marriage in Russia.
Yeah.
This news will not make Syrians happy.
What?
Well,
that's correct. Yeah, that's okay. We'll blame it on some plot, some Zionist plot.
Yeah.
I love that dog. You didn't hear that for about 10, 15 years, but now that kind of revolutionary dog was, you know, it's all coming back, and it sounds just as silly now as it did before. I mean, who writes their stuff? What's that? Oh, that's true, I guess. It depends on which side you're listening to, right? Yeah, it's true. In any event, so here you see there's a certain relationship between the two nations. If he was a great man before his master, that would be Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, or more specifically Aram Damascus, Aram Damascus. Unesu fanim, and he was, you know, he carried his face high, you know, that he had great status. Kivonatan Adonai Chuat Aram. I mean, look at that, because God, through him, gave success to Aram. Va'ish haya gibor chayil. He was a great warrior. Umitzaran. He was also a leper. But just the fact that the Navi, somebody from Elisha's school, could write that God was working for the Syrians. First of all, theologically, you have to think about it. We always wonder, does God work for the non-Jews? Here's a case where he clearly does. The question is, how do you identify it or not identify it? Now, the problem is that the Aramites, the Aram is fighting Israel as well. You see what I'm saying? Which would seem to indicate that the Navi is admitting that when Syria wins a battle against Israel, that God is helping him to do so. But just the very fact that God is sort of associated with Syria gives you a feeling that there's a closeness between the nations. So if Aram, I'm sorry,
God is angry at Israel.
Yeah, that's possible, but it sounds... The truth is, you're right. It would in a normal case where God was allowing the enemies to win, it would say Hashem Natan bi Adam. But here it uses a different phrase. It says Natan Hashem Teshuah LaAram. He gave Aram salvation through the hands of Naaman. So normally, where God gets involved and makes us lose, it's put in a negative term. But here, what you have is that Hashem is giving salvation to Aram. You don't get this often. Teshuah l'bnei Yisrael, Teshuah l'David, Teshuah is salvation. God saves. It's a very unusual to have that kind of positive attitude towards Naaman.
Don't we believe that God is active not just in Israel, but with runs the whole world?
I think we do, and I think that this is one. If you want to, you know, an example that God is involved with people when they are right-minded. And we see that Naaman, you know, while he's still an idol worshiper at this point, he's at least, you know, spiritually inclined. He recognizes God, that God does, in fact, work for non-Jewish people. And sometimes, if he's working for them more than us, it can go against our best interest. And I think this would be a classic pasuk to prove that that the Jewish people shouldn't be so sanguine about the fact that we have God in our back pockets. I think it's a foolish and naive philosophy, and I'd say it goes against Tanakh. I think it goes literally against Tanakh. This is one of these classic psukim where people should read Tanakh better and get a better understanding, I think, of how Hashem works. V'aram yatzu gdudim v'yishvu me'eretz Yisrael narak Tanakh. So essentially, Aram had gone out in his forces, and they had captured a small girl. Doesn't mean just a small girl. They went out to battle and they got one girl. No, but among the people they got was a small girl. Vati lifnei eshet Naaman, and she became a servant of the wife of Naaman, the general's wife. Vatomer gvirta, so she says to her mistress, Achali, it's funny, like the Nevi'im are not freaking out about the fact that Israel lost a war. The Nevi'im are focused on the big picture. How does this affect, you know, the larger picture? The Nevi'im, very often, they're not interested in a certain battle. You know, they don't want to even, we don't even never heard of this battle before, and all we know, we don't know how many people lost or died or captured. All we know is one girl who may or may not change the course of history. because God takes the long view of things rather than the short view of things. We tend to react because we live very short lives, but God doesn't, so he tends to look at the bigger scheme, and what seems important to us is completely unimportant to God sometimes, and vice versa. So Vatomer leGvirtach Alei Adoni Lifnei Anavi Asher B'Sharon. So Rashi says Achalei is a slightly different word, but Yachel Yisrael El Adonai means pray. Yachel is to pray. The problem is that an Aleph is not a Yud. On the other hand, it's Aramaic, not Hebrew. She's clearly speaking Aramaic because very few words start with an Aleph in Hebrew, but a lot start in Aramaic. So I think we'll go with Rashi's Achalei. I've seen other interpretations, but I like the idea that it's to pray. So Achalei Adoni Lifnei HaMelech Lifnei HaNavi Asher B'Sharon. So go to Navi who's in Sharon. Now this is also a jump. Why? Because where's the Navi living? He's in Sharon, the capital city. You follow? At first he was in Har Carmel with the woman, then he was in Gilgal, which is down by Jericho afterwards, and now he's in Shomron. So one thing I guarantee you for sure, Ahab's dynasty is not in power, because there's no way that Elisha will be hanging around in Shomron, having nothing to... Remember, Elisha didn't want to... Remember when Elisha, they all went to battle, and Ahab's son said, they ran out of water, and Ahab's son said, I want to speak, who's a prophet here? And Elisha, and they said, Elisha's a prophet here. And Ahab said, I want you to pray, you know, I want you to tell me what's going on. He goes, I'm not talking to you. I'll talk to that guy, Yehoshaphat, but you, we're not talking. Even after Yehoram admitted that it was God causing the issues, it was almost in a firm way to a certain extent, Elisha was having nothing to do with him. So I doubt very much that this is during Elisha's time. It's in Yehu's time. We haven't met Yehu yet, but we will. He's the one who topples the dynasty of Ahab.
He tells him to go pray to Baal.
Who?
When they came to him that time to
Yehoram?
For water. That he should pray for water. Elisha told him to go.
Oh yeah, that's right. Go pray to your father's gods. Don't bother me.
Yeah, right.
Right. So even though Yehoram is trying to say, "Listen, I believe in God," he's like, "Yeah, don't give me that fake from you know, that's my that's what do they call that 5-minute conversion? Like when you're in trouble. So what do they call that? Like when no atheist in trenches or a fair weather Baal Tshuva, you know. So essentially he tells him, you know, get lost, I know who's on your side. So I doubt that he would be hanging out in Shomron with Elisha, you know, I doubt Elisha would be in Shomron. This must be much later. But again, it gives you an indication that these stories are being stitched together not for chronological reasons, but to tell you phases of his work and what he was able to accomplish. So Achalei Adoni Lifnei HaNavi Asher B'Sharon. So go pray in front of the Navi which is in Shomron. She says, then he'll, you know, no more tzarat, because Elisha could do those kind of things. Obviously, people believe that either he was a great medicine man, or that he was able to perform miracles. Also, it's very strange that this girl would be sort of rooting, so to speak. You know, it shows a certain relationship between Aram. The fact that the girl would be trying to help out Naaman, you know, why would she care? She's just a slave. Obviously, she must have been treated well. You know, what I'm trying to say is that we're not, you know, you're not talking about Nebuchadnezzar here. You're talking about two nations which are perhaps even at this stage not so far apart that that bridges can't be, that ravines can't be bridged, and that's exactly what's going to happen. So, Vayavo Vayagei Ladonav, so we skipped the part where the wife tells the husband, we just assume that that's true, and the husband goes to his master, who's the king, he says, Kazod Chazod Dibra Narad, this is what this girl said, Hashem Eretz Yisrael, who's an Israeli. One of the few times that you see Me'eretz Yisrael, it's used here, in this little section here. It's very usually not used, but here it is, Eretz Yisrael. Vayomer Melech Aram Lech Bo, so go and come to him. Ve'eshlecha Sefer El Melech Yisrael. I'll write a message to scroll to the king of Israel. Vayelech Vayikach Biado Eser Kikrei Kesef, take 10 talents of silver, it's a decent amount of cash. The Sheshel Afim Zahav, and 6,000 gold pieces, I always get a kick out of this next part. The Eser Chalifot Gadim, and ten chains of clothes, which always get a kick out, because like, oh, and on the way, stop off at the Gap and take stop off. But obviously, clothes were quite expensive back then. It was they didn't have industrial, so I'm sure sewing together a good pair of clothes, especially ones that felt good, as opposed to your usual leather or coarse wool thing, was probably a pretty expensive business.
Yeah,
but I always like, you know, it's gold, silver, and a bunch of clothes, because today that seems, you know, almost laughable. But obviously, back then things had a different cost based on supply and demand. Vayaveh Sefer El Melech Yisrael Emor. So they brought the scroll, and it sounds like this. Vata kivo Sefer Azeh Elecha. As you read this scroll, Hinei Shalachti Elecha Naaman Avdi. Along with it is coming my servant Naaman, who they know as a general. V'asafto mitzarato. And essentially, I want him cured of his tzarat. Because the people don't really... Now, the question is, why didn't they go to Elisha, right? She told them to go to Elisha. The king says, I'll send a message to the king because I'll just assume the king will get it taken care of. Which means he assumes that the king, you have to interpret this, why would he go and tell the king something that only the prophet could do? He would have to assume that it works like it does in his country. Who's in charge of prophecy? Who's in charge of the magicians? Like Pharaoh, right? Pharaoh decides what the magicians do, when the magicians do it, and how it's going to go. And the magicians try to say as nice things they can to the king. So in Ben-Hadad's mind, because he doesn't really have a Jewish mindset, he doesn't see Elisha as a free agent, which Elisha absolutely is, especially since Elisha is now living in Shomron. He sees Elisha as a minion of the king. The king will tell him to perform miracles, and he'll say, abracadabra, perform miracles. So you see there's kind of a mental disconnect or a theological disconnect between what can be done. Something sad happens here. Well, something funny happens here. Right? He can crow Melch Yisrael at Sefer. Vayikrab Gav, when he reads the letter, he rips his clothes. Vayomer Elohim, Anna Lahami, Vayomer HaElohim. He says, good Lord. Ani La... One second. Vayomer HaElohim, Ani Lahamit Ulahachayot. Oh, I'm sorry. No. And he says, HaElohim Ani, what am I, a god? Lahamit Ulahachayot? I could cure. What am I? What am I supposed to do to cure this poor guy with Tzarat? He says, Shalech Alay Lasof Mishmin Tzaratol. I'm supposed to cure him of his leprosy? Or maybe psoriasis, really. Tzaratol probably is. The word psoriasis probably comes from Tzaratol. You know what he's looking for? He's looking for an excuse to attack me. Mitaneh, a toana, is like he's looking for some kind of plot or excuse. Oh, that guy is trying to treat our general badly. We're going to attack him. He's looking for some kind of fake. But he kishmo Elisha ish Elohim. So Elisha hears it. Kikara melacha begadav. So he heard that the king ripped his clothes. By yishlach, which means he had a good network of information bringers. By the way, always important for a navi. Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Well, you know. They may have been approved by the king. No reason to assume they weren't approved by the king. But surely anything that happened in the government, which also shows you that he's now involved in at the king level. Up to this point, we've had his own people, the prophet school, the rich people, rich woman, poor old lady, and now he's actually getting involved in the political arena. He's living in Shomron. He's got, if not spies, but he certainly knows what's going on as far as the king goes. Vayishlach ha-melech le'mor, lama karat begadecha? What are you doing, ripping your clothes? This is the first time we've seen a prophet of the north advise the king, which is also a massive change. So step, 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 and now we have Elisha as a positive influence on the king of Israel. Just another step in Elisha's success. Yavo Na'ilai, let the guy come to me. V'yeda kiyesh navi b'Yisrael, and those Aramites will know that there is a prophet in Israel. V'yavo Na'amam Susav, so he comes with this horse. Uvrechvo, his chariots. Vayamod petach habayit le'Elisha. So he stands in front of Elisha's house. Vayishlach elav Elisha malach le'mor. So he sends him out a messenger. The question is, it's very funny. This is probably Gehazi also. The question is, why different names for Gehazi? We have him as Nar. We have him as Misharet. We have him as Malach. Hard to say. Maybe there's more to read in here than... But I don't know what it was in action. I'm sure some people would say I didn't see it myself. But I'm sure... Probably somebody says it was an actual angel, but right now it's probably Gehazi. Haloch v'rachatzda sheva pamim yardein. Go dip yourself in the water. Right? It's usually not a good thing because someone's going to dunk himself in the water. Vayashov b'sarcha l'chao tahor. Your flesh will come back and you'll be purified. I like that word tahor because it gives you the religious sense as well as just the medical sense. Vayiktof naman vayelach. So he got really upset. He took a walk. Vayomer hine amarti elai. I said to myself, Yetzei yatso, he'll surely come out. Ve'amad, and he'll stand up. Ve'kara b'shem Adonai Elohav, and he'll call the name of his God. Ve'hinif yado, he'll wave around his hand. El makom, and to the place where I have tzarat, v'asaf, and so the whole thing will go gone. Abracadabra. Okay? That's what he's expecting. That's the kind of prophecy on one hand that Eliyahu did, the kind of stuff that Eliyahu did, but it's certainly the kind of shamanistic rituals that you would have in a polytheistic Aram. He's expecting miracles. He heard that this guy is super miracle man, and he has a theological shock because what kind of guy, what kind of prophet tells you to dump yourself in a river? Halo tov amanau farfar naharot damesek. You know what? We got nice rivers in Damascus. Mikol me'mei Yisrael, and now it becomes like a nationalistic thing. What, your water is better than our water? Our water is just fine. If I want to dunk myself, I can dunk myself. Halo echatz b'hem v'taharti, I become pure in them. Vayifen vayelech b'chimah. He left very angry. It's very interesting what he was expecting as opposed to what he got. Vayikshu avatav, however, his servants came to him, vayidavru elav, they said to him, vayomru avi, father, which really means master, devar gadol hanavi dibir elach, he told you a great thing, don't dismiss so fast. Halo taseh, why don't you try it out. Just like he said to you, you become pure. And he dipped himself in the water 7 times. Remind me if we have time to talk about the number 7, because if you remember, Elisha also placed himself in front of the dead child 7 times as well. That number is very significant. I don't know if I'll have time to talk about it now, but maybe another time. Kidvar Yisraelim, Vayasha b'sarok kibsar, kibsar na'ar katon, Vayitar, and his flesh came back to him like a little boy, and he was purified.
He went back home already?
No, he was on the way. He walked away in anger. I think he'd already left Shomron on the way to go home and said, forget you.
He took his servants with him.
Yeah, he said, sure, his servants were coming with him, and then they stopped and said, give it a shot. So he gets essentially the Jordan is probably the border between Israel and Aram, if Aram is aggressive, which it is, because they managed to capture Israeli captives.
Is that where Elisha told them to?
Go to the Jordan and dip. Yeah. Vayashav el ha'ish Elohim. So he comes back now, obviously, to the Navi, to Elisha. Hu v'chol machaneh, comes with his entire camp. Now, by the way, it's very interesting that he's got an army with him, a small army with him, and Israel is doing nothing about it. Which shows you probably that Aram at this point had a certain upper hand in the whole relationship. I think it's a positive sense. Like, you know what? When I come back to you, I'm going to bring everybody with me to show you, because he's not going to attack them. He's going to go in peace. Mm-hmm. So it's a sense, where like I'm bringing you my forces, and essentially they're at your disposal almost. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a positive thing, even though it's surprising that he'd be able to walk in with an army, but probably, 100 soldiers. Now I know. Wow. Now this is really good. Now here the word bracha doesn't mean blessing, it means thank you. The word bracha, probably more than it means blessing, means thank you in many cases in Tanakh. I want you to take from me a thank you, a gift for what you did to me. Now this is we're right at the, this is a big moment. Because if Naaman now believes that ain't Elohim except for Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, sure the Aramites probably believed in Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. They had enough relationship with Israel to believe in Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei along with all their other gods. But what you have is the general of the army essentially converting. He's saying, I now recognize that the only God, not a powerful God, the only God is the one that's in Israel. Ki'im bi-Yisrael. Vatakach na bracha me'et avdecha. And I want you to take this gift from my hands. Remember, he came with all the silver and golden clothes. Vayomer Chai Adonai, and Elisha says, no way, I swear to God, Asher Amadi Lefanav, who I stood before him, which means he's acting very much like Eliyahu, right? Who I stood before. Imet Kach, I will not take it. Vayifzarbo, he pressured him, Lakachat, Vayima Ein, he refused to take it. So which means Elisha is really standing on his gun, and he won't take it, for a very simple reason, by the way. He won't take it because it's a little like a Jewish guilt thing. He has an advantage, right? Because if he gets paid for his services, I don't owe you anything. But if Naaman owes him something for saving his life, but there's another thing also. It's a religious thing. If he just takes money, so he's like all the Nevi'im I've ever heard of. You give him a little money to tell you what you want to hear. If they're powerful, you give him a little money and they perform a miracle or two. But essentially, they're not leaders. They're functionaries. They work. They're shamans to a certain extent. This guy may be a more powerful shaman. He may be a shaman of the one god.
Well,
but he's still just
a faker.
What I meant by shaman is that he works for money. That's what he works for. He's not a leader. He's not a rebbe. He's just a you pay him. He does the job and end of story. So that's also something which Elisha doesn't want to happen. There are two issues. One, he wants Naaman to be indebted to him, which is good. But I think he also wants to show him that, I don't take money for this business. I tell you, perform a miracle, I'm performing a miracle on this story. I don't need nothing from you. I'm going to do it because God said I could do it. So let's continue on. Vayomer Naaman valo and not, which really means, okay, I accept that you're not going to take it. Yutan na lavdecha masat semed pradim adama. Therefore, so to speak, I want you to give to your servant a double load of earth, Ki lo yaseh od avdecha olav azevach l'elohim acharim ki'im la'ashem. What I'm going to do is, I'm going to take an altar back. I want the land of Israel. It's like one of those Bibles that says, land of Israel, heir of Israel. I'm going to take a double amount of earth. I'm going to bring it back to Syria with me. I'm going to build an altar, because again, Naaman's, he's trying his best, but there's still the paganist extent, because he believes that God is attached to the land. As each land has a land. But okay, you can't expect, a complete and total, he's not Ruth, he doesn't completely get it right away. But look what he says. He's so impressed by the fact that the Navi won't take any money. He doesn't ask him for the land to make an altar in his own state beforehand. But when he sees that Elisha won't take any funds, that's what apparently convinces him that now, what I'm going to do? I'm going to take an altar back to my own home and I'm going to pray to God myself. It's very impressive. Verse 18. Ladavar, and now look at this. He asks him for tshuva. This is a little bit again. Maybe he's misunderstanding things. It's like a pope. He's asking him for. Absolution. He says, "Ladavar zeh yislach Adonai lavdecha." I want God to forgive His servant, i.e., me, Naaman, the following: Bivo Adoni Beit Rimon, my master, the king of Aram, is going to go to Beit Rimon, which is the house of of idol worship. He's going to bow down to him. V'hu nishan el yadi. He leans on my, when he bows down, it's like Yom Kippur, when the guy goes down to bow down and two people help you up. So essentially, when he bows down, in order, the only people who are going to pick up the king are going to be his generals, his second in command. V'hu nishan el yadi. He'll be resting in his hands. V'hishtachaveti beit rimon. I'll have no choice but to essentially go down with him. V'hishtachavayati beit rimon. And when I bow down in the house of Rimon, which I know is like the ceremony I got coming up, yislach Adonai l'avcha v'davar zeh. Please forgive me for this type of thing. It's a very interesting thing. It's really very interesting. I have to go to this, company invited me to go to this unkosher restaurant, so I want you to forgive me for the fact that, I have to, chug a... What's that? Correct, and asking tshuva for them. Tremendous stuff. Vayomer lo lech l'shalom. A little vague, right? Go in peace. Okay, I don't know, is that absolution or is that absolution? So the Mephoshim go crazy here. Some say that, they don't go crazy, they have different opinions. Some say he didn't have to forgive him because he wasn't doing anything wrong, because you're not Jewish. You can't blaspheme God, it doesn't necessarily say anything about, what else you could do worship-wise. It's a big machloket about whether he was telling him that it's okay or whether he was avoiding the question because he wasn't trying to make a Jew out of him. But either way, he says, Lech l'shalom. I think the simple read is just saying, no, don't worry about it, you're doing fine. Vayelech meito kivrat aretz. And he went from him kivrat aretz, by the way, which reminds you of the Rachel story. Yaakov was kivrat aretz. He was a distance of kivrat aretz from Beit El when meita alav Rachel. Rachel died on Yaakov. Bivo kivrat aretz, which according to most portion is an acre, a length of land. So once again, we have like Bereshit coming back. Vayomer Gehazi nar Elisha ish Elohim. So Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, and when they say the man of God, they're not talking about Gehazi, they're talking about Elisha. Hine chasach Adoni et Naaman harami azeh mikacham yado et asher vi. He let him go free. Chasach means he let him escape for nothing. Chai Hashem, I swear to God. Ki ratzti acharav lakati meito muhuma. I'm going to run after, I'm going to take some cash. Wow. See, now you don't need Chazal to do a character assassination on Gehazi. Gehazi's character comes out. But not only does he say that he's going to go against his master and go take something his master didn't want him to do, he's going to swear to God that he could do it, which is unbelievable, which is just unbelievable what kind of guy Gehazi was. Vayudov Gehazi acharei Naaman, so he runs after him. Vayiren Naaman ratzachav vayipol me'al ha'merkava l'krato. He heaves himself from the merkava. He sees Gehazi coming. Now he knows Gehazi because Gehazi is the guy who's standing right next to Elisha, and he probably assumes that it works like it does in Syria. That's your right hand man. The guy speaks for you, which is probably how it should work in Israel also. By the way, you recognize those words vayipol me'al ha'merkava. The other words that you might recognize vayipol me'al ha'gamal. That's when Rivka comes and she sees Yitzchak and she's so blown away by Yitzchak, and probably not his good looks, but by the very presence of Yitzchak, and she heaves herself, so to speak, from the Gamal. Another time that it says it is also during from a Chamor, when Kalev's daughter heaved himself at her in order to get some. She was begging for some property, and he gave her some property. That was back in Yeshayahu, Yoshua, and the beginning of Shoftim. So she kind of heaves herself. But what it's telling you is like this massive just how, what do you want? It's just, you got, essentially they have Naaman right where they want him in a religious, in a positive sense. Vayomer HaShalom, is everything okay? And you recognize those words? Those words are from, those words were repeated over and over by the Shunammite woman over and over. So again, you can see that there's editing going on here to unite these stories. Vayomer Shalom Adoni, Shalom Adoni Shlachani Lemor. My master sent me saying, Hine Ataze Baoi Lashnein Na'arime Arfrayim. Two servants. Again, here you have to emphasize, whenever it drives me crazy whenever I see the word nar translated as young boy, when it's clear that it's not what it means. These are the prophets that she's talking about. A prophet is a prophet who serves the main prophet is a nar. He's a Kohen. He's a Misharet. Shnei narim harfaimi b'nei anivim t'na lahem kikar kesef. Now, where these two boys came from, I don't know. I guess he swore to them and made them come along with him. I'm not sure exactly what's going on. I want you to give them one piece of bread, ushtei chalifot, I'm sorry, one piece of silver, ushtei chalifot b'gadim, and I want you to give them 2/6 of the stuff, no gold, but 1/10 of the silver that you have. Vayomer Noan, hoel kach kikrayim. No, no. Not one, take two. It's like a deal. We have a special deal today, two for the price of one. Vayifratzbo, vayitzar kikrai, vayatzar kikrai, and kesef, he ties up the two kesef, v'shtei charitim, in two bags, v'shtei chalifo p'gadim, he gives him 2 chains of clothes, vayitain et shnei na'arav, v'yisu l'fanav, he gives him 2 servants to take the silver. Vayavola, ofel, they come to the ofel. I'm going to avoid the word ofel right now, probably some kind of secretive place that was available for the king. It's not clear what's going on here. Vayikach mi adam, vayifkod b'vayit, so he puts them in the house, hides it away in the house. Vayishlach anashim eleichem, and then he sends these servants away. This is Gehazi, who sends the servants of Naaman back. V'hu vavi amod al ananav, and then he comes back to his servant, he stands in front of Elisha, his master. Vayomer lavi Elisha, me ayin Gehazi, so Gehazi, where are you coming from? Vayomer lo halach abdecha ana v'ana, I went nowhere. Can you imagine? And unfortunately, this may be a little bit of Elisha's fault, because Elisha was the one who kept empowering Gehazi over and over again, because he felt that that's what you have to do. You got to empower your servant. The only problem is if you pick the wrong servant, you know, you Peter principle somebody out, and it's a disaster for everybody. So look at this. He swears to God that he's going to go against his master, and his master asks him where he was, and he lies to his master. Wow. You know, that's bad. Vayomer lav lo libi halach. Vayomer lav. Lowly be halach kasher afach ish me'al merkavol katecha. You don't think my heart went on me? What's that?
Is it my heart with thee? Not my heart with thee.
Why do you have with thee? I don't know why you would. Vayom elav, he said to him, lowly be halach. Is it not true that my heart went? I don't know why they're ending the word thee there. Do you have thee there?
Did not my heart go along?
Go along. I don't like either of those translations. I'll tell you what it means. It's like my heart. I lost my heart.
Did my heart not go along?
Right, but what it means... So what it means is, don't you think that my heart knows what you're doing? That is, my heart follows you. And of course, the heart was a sign of intelligence, but I don't think that's what he means. I think what he means is the disaster that happens, because once Naaman does a payoff, Naaman's free to go. We'll see, that's the end of this. No, Naaman never shows up again. He never comes back and says thank you. He never builds an altar for God. Syria does not become a monotheism. It all disappears there. Because he thinks that Elisha has changed his mind and said, I do want money. And then all of Naaman's great thoughts and all the things that made him want to take an altar back to his own home are up in smoke. So I believe what this means is, lowly be halach. Don't you think I lost my heart? My heart took off. Kasher hafach isho mer kavod kratacha. Because it doesn't really mean when he went to you. It's, don't you think I went? My heart went when he jumped out of his chariot. And not only that, look at the word hafach. You know what hafach usually means? Changed. When his heart changed, my heart changed. And that's the correct read. I don't like this English, and I certainly don't like that English. That's the sense like, oh, I'm a prophet, I know exactly what you're doing, I got spies. That's not what it means. It means there was such a rift in the force. I hate to use like Star Trek terms, but there was such a ripple in the force when Naaman, who he had in his hands as a man who was taking his bath back to Mizrach Hashem, back to Syria, is now lost. He could feel the disaster. He knows what happens without even knowing what happens, because he feels that tremor in the force.
Yeah, interesting comment.
What's the comment?
Elisha, through prophetic vision, my heart knew exactly what happened. Targum said that. Gehazi's greed had detracted from the sanctification of God's name that had resulted from Elisha's unselfish aid to ailing strangers.
Correct, absolutely. But I think what even that comment doesn't notice is the word hafach. My heart left me, when he changed, when hu hafach. Kasher hafach ha'ish me'al merkavo. It doesn't just mean he turned around. Hafach merkavo, didn't hafach merkavo. Hafach merkavo sounds like all he did was turn around. That's not what he did. He jumped out of his chariot. So the word hafach indicates a change of person, I think, here. Ha'it lakachet ta'kesef. You think now's the time to take the silver? The lakachet gadim and clothes, zeitim ukramim, betzon bakar v'adim u'shvachot. Now, he didn't take all those things. But what is he telling me? He said, we're not a profit business. We don't do it for the vineyards. Of course we could get all the money in the world. But we don't do it. Not only that, the last time a guy brought me a piece of bread, I fed everybody else with it. We're not in it for the money. That's not what this business is all about. We're not doctors to take money. Sorry, I'm not trying to promote socialist medicine or anything like that. But or rabbis. I want you to know, I got to tell you, maybe I shouldn't record this, but I tell you, the rabbis with big salaries, I don't understand it. I cannot understand some of that. Your job, you're a public servant. Like, we don't have to take vows of poverty. But a rabbi who is a navi of modern times, his job is to live a socialist life. That's my philosophy. I get it from here and other places, and I stand by it. I've had arguments with people. You know, how could a rabbi live? Rabbi has to send his kids to school, and rabbi has to do this, rabbi does that. I stand by it. But if you wanted an expensive life, so go become a computer programmer or a doctor. You want a life of service, so go be a rabbi. I'm sorry, that's my second shot against doctors. What?
Investment banker.
I'm sorry, investment banker. But I feel about this, I know I'm giving Musar now instead of teaching Tanakh, but I think my Musar is coming directly from the Tanakh. I think that's where the philosophy comes from. I hope I'm not reading into the Tanakh. I think what he's talking to is, listen, we're in the business of helping people. And what he's saying is, we take nothing. We don't take tzom, we don't take bakar, we don't take avadim, we don't take shvachot, we take nothing, zero. It's a no-cash business.
But this guy brought the loaves of bread and whatever else that
he brought. And he gave it away.
Also,
there's a difference between, keep in mind, people were starving to death at the time. So really, it was substance. Listen, I'm not trying to say rabbis shouldn't get anything. But and by the way, right. A minimum standard to live in a minimum standard way. And by the way, this is a halach of the Rambam that everybody always throws away. Cause everybody loves the Rambam, they love him. And the Rambam says something that people don't like, so they throw him away. The Rambam says that you're not allowed to get payment for Torah at all. You can't get payment as a Torah teacher. So what's the heter the Rambam gives? Essentially, you're only allowed to be paid for the lost wages. Oh, so you could argue, okay, I could have been an investment banker, so I'll give you $400,000, and that's my lost wages. But new mamela, okay, so I guess that's a heter, but it's not a heter that I... To me, it goes against what Elisha is trying to teach his prophets. In my mind, the rabbi today is a modern-day prophet. The tzarat na'aman tidbak b'cha. And because of what you did, the psoriasis, or the skin disease of Naaman is going to attach to you, uvizarcha, which means it's now a genetic disease, v'yetzemul fanav mitzora kashalag. And now you got... Now there's no dipping, there's no hidden miracles in nature. Bam, he goes out like a tzarat. Vayomru b'nei ha-nevi'im el Elisha, hinei an...
He went out with...
And he went out with tzarat. And that's a good place. Actually, I'm sorry, that's chapter 6. So we'll continue. So we got through chapter 5 as well. So that's essentially the story. And I think it's clear. Unfortunately, this is one of those moments where it's a nice story, but it's a little bit depressing because... It's one of those moments in history where you can really say we almost had it, you know. If only this had happened, then really the history of Israel may have been changed. And and the question is, it's depressing. It is depressing, but the prophet has to write it, because if he didn't write it, then there's a fear that it might happen again. Unfortunately, even though we have a Navi in front of us, it still happens again. But what can you do? You teach Navi and you hope people learn the lessons. That's the best that's the best you could do. It's better than not having it written at all and pretending that everything is just copacetic. Anyway, have a good night, and next time we'll do chapter 6.